From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Peter Diamandis is an unabashed optimist. His XPRIZE Foundation has awarded millions of dollars and promised millions more to inventors of spaceships, super-efficient cars, moon rovers, genome sequencers, and more breakthrough innovations. In his new book, Abundance, the XPRIZE founder paints a big, bright vision of the future. He says human innovation is strong and getting stronger, that within a generation, we'll be muscled up to provide abundant food, water, housing, education, healthcare, energy, goods and services once reserved for the wealthy few to all globally. Wow, great. This hour On Point, are we on track for abundance? Joining me now from Cypress, California is Peter Diamandis, big thinker, CEO of the XPRIZE Foundation. He also founded Singularity University and International Space University. Last month, he launched his seventh XPRIZE contest with a $10 million prize for whoever creates a Star Trek-style medical scanner to size up our health and prescribe treatment. His new book with Stephen Kotler is Abundance. The future is better than you think. Peter Diamandis, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
So what's coming? We're all worried.
You know, it's interesting because the media feeds us constantly negative news stories, and there's a reason for that. We pay attention to them because that's the way our brain is designed from evolutionary times, to pay attention to any negative news. We actually have a structure in our brain called the amygdala that puts us on high alert when we hear that. And you know, the old saying, if it bleeds, it leads, is very true. So on every digital device we have, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, we're constantly pumped. Every local skirmish, warfare, economic turndown in the planet. And so no wonder we're worried. No wonder people are pessimistic. But maybe the world is actually a little bit different from the way we see it on our digital devices.
Maybe. I mean, all right. So, but fair enough. We'll put our amygdala aside for a minute here and turn on our rational minds. We're still waiting to hear your case. What is it? What's coming?
Well, let's look first of all at what's happened in the last 100 years. We've had an extraordinary century of progress, and a number of forces have put that in place. So just a quick tour of the last 100 years. The human lifespan has more than doubled. The average per capita income for every human on the planet has more than tripled. The childhood mortality has come down a factor of 10. If you look at the cost of food, it's 10 times cheaper. The cost of electricity is 20 times cheaper. Communications and transportation 100 to 1,000 times cheaper. And Steven Pinker just wrote a book showing that we're living in the most peaceful time ever in human history. Things have been getting really a lot better, and the forces in play are actually accelerating and giving us a future that I think, and my co-author Stephen Kotler, as we project looking forward, the basic needs of humanity have the potential to be met over the next couple of decades. And it's tough for people to actually see that.
You know, well, I mean, let's hear it because, I mean, you talk about peace and we know about Steven Pinker's thesis, but we all saw the 20th century and there was a fair amount of war there. And we all read our, mutual fund cautions, you know, past results, no guarantee of future performance, even if we had a lot of great innovation in the 20th century. What's your case that we're on track for it to be better? I mean, we also see the photographs of the Arctic ice cap going away. And, you know, there's plenty of things you can look at which are scientific measures, which are unsettling with our amygdala still off the table here. So what's your case that it's a good track we're on?
So my case is the following. We talk about there being scarcity in energy and water and people concerned about health and education. And let me just knock down on those four.
Okay.
There's a great story that I'll give as an analogy. Napoleon III in the mid-1800s had the King of Siam over for dinner. And all of Napoleon's troops ate with silver utensils. Napoleon himself ate with gold utensils. And the King of Siam was fed with aluminum utensils because aluminum back then was the rarest element on the planet.
Because we didn't know how to pull it out of the earth.
Basically, aluminum doesn't occur in pure form in the earth. Mm-hmm. It's all formed bauxite. And we ended up – it was so difficult to extract pure aluminum that it was the rarest, worth more than gold and platinum. And that's why the top of the Washington Monument is capped with aluminum. And this technology of electrolysis came along and made it so cheap that now we use it with throwaway mentality. If you look at energy on Earth and people talk about energy scarcity and the difficulties we have, The Earth is bathed in energy. We actually have 5,000 times more energy that hits the Earth's surface in a year than we consume as a human species. We use about 16 terawatts of energy, which hits us in every 88 minutes. And so it's not a matter of whether the energy's there. It's how do we make it accessible? And there's good news in this matter. Last year, the cost of solar dropped 50% in cost. In India, for example, it was cheaper to have solar from electricity from solar was 8 rupees versus in the U.S. versus 17 rupees for diesel. And MIT just projected that by the end of this decade, by 2020, the cost of electricity, at least in the sunny parts of the U.S., will be 6 cents a kilowatt hour compared to a national average of 15 cents. So we have the potential to really ultimately need 100% and 500%, 1,000%, have an abundant amount of energy. And that's part of the equation.
You're talking just about energy there. Though, I mean, sure. We know how large those challenges are. We know people still want to use a lot of fossil fuels to do that. There's the big debate over tar sands. A lot of Americans, you know, when they think innovation, Americans, I think, sort of naturally want to believe in it. On the other hand, we remember George W. Bush talking about the hydrogen fuel solution that didn't show up. And, you know, not everything shows.
Absolutely. I wouldn't agree with you more than that. But we're living in a day and age that there is more technology in the hand of young entrepreneurs than ever before. So what I speak about is the notion that we're exponentially growing technologies on the back of Moore's Law. So for example, you go today to a Best Buy and you buy a laptop. It's twice as fast for the same price as last year. And that's Moore's Law. It's been continuing for documented fashion mm-hmm. for well about 100 years. And it's projected to go forward and continue forward. But riding on the back of Moore's Law are a set of other technologies that empower us: artificial intelligence, robotics, synthetic biology, digital medicine, 3D printing. And these are tools that innovators around the planet can utilize to really attack some of the grand challenges. The most important point I could make in short is that, you know, I don't have faith that the large corporations and the governments are going to solve our problems. But what I do have faith in, and I've learned this and seen this with the XPRIZE Foundation, is the ability for small teams who can literally do what large corporations and governments could only have done in the past. You know, we see entrepreneurs who today can literally touch the lives of a billion people. I was with a guy yesterday who's one of our great DIY innovators. He's on my board at XPRIZE.
DIY, do it yourself. Just go out and do it.
Do it yourself. Mm-hmm. It's a mindset of I'm not going to wait for someone else to do it. I'm going to solve it myself. His name is Dean Kamen. Most people sure. know him for creating the Segway, mm-hmm. but he has 600-odd patents to his name. And Dean has a device called the Slingshot. It's the size of a small dorm room refrigerator, if you can imagine that.
We hope it's not another buggy just to go around on two wheels. We need something bigger here.
The Slingshot's a device that uses about only 100 watts of power. It's okay. about as much as your average hairdryer, less than your hairdryer. And it generates 1,000 liters of water per day, of clean drinking water. In fact, it's the cleanest possible water that you can produce.
Generates it out of what, Peter? What goes in?
You stick it anything that's wet, the latrine, salt water, arsenic-laden water, anything that contains water in it. And it extracts clean drinking water out of that material. And what's interesting is he's had this technology for a while, but what we were able to announce yesterday is mm-hmm. that he struck a deal with the chairman of one of the largest companies in the world, Coca-Cola, that they're going to be doing a multi-hundred unit test. And if this test of a number of 100 units in work, Coke's prepared to deploy this globally in 206 countries. That's extraordinary.
Coke needs water. Coca-Cola needs water to make Coke. They're up the creek without it. You know, but
let's add to the fact that it's less than 2 cents a liter to produce this kind of drinking water,
and it's incredible. If it works, you know, there's one great big unchecked box about water shortages that would be really comforting to see checked. That'd be fantastic. Do we have enough innovation going on across the horizon of challenges? I mean, you write about 1 in 4 animals facing extinction, 90% of fish gone, aquifers drying up, soil too salty. Do we have enough to hit this pretty intimidating array of challenges, Peter?
Well, here you go, hitting us on the amygdala again.
I'm quoting you, my brother.
But the fact of the matter is, let's look at healthcare. We're living in a day and age right now where in the United States alone, by the end of 2020, we're going to be short 91,000 doctors. We can't train enough doctors, and that's great compared to the rest of the world. In Africa, that has 25% of the disease burden, we have only 1.3% of the healthcare workers. One of the things that I recently had the chance to announce along with Paul Jacobs from Qualcomm, backed by the Qualcomm Foundation, is, as you mentioned in the run-up, the $10 million Qualcomm Tricorder X Prize. So we have offered out $10 million to the team that can combine artificial intelligence, lab on a chip, digital medicine, cloud computing, to be able to diagnose you better than a team of board-certified doctors with a handheld mobile device.
The old Star Trek device. We'll look at that and a lot more with Peter Diamandis. He's co-author of the new book, Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think. So bright, we've got to wear shades. 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I'm doing all right, getting good grades. The future's so bright.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the quality of our future. Let's listen back for just a moment. More than 100 years. Here's Thomas Edison. This is at the opening of the New York Electric Show, 1908, and certainly Edison had brought a whole lot of innovation that really changed things. Here he is back in the day.
When I look around at the resources of the electrical field today, I feel that I would be glad to begin again my work as an electrician, an inventor, and we veterans can only urge upon our successors, the younger followers of Franklin and of Kelvin, to realize the measure of their opportunities and to rise to the height of their responsibilities in this day of electricity.
Thomas Edison, 1908. So here we are, 2012. Are we set with innovation in the pipeline that is up to the challenges of the century right in front of us? Peter Diamandis says yes. We're going to hear in a moment from somebody who's maybe not quite as sunnily optimistic. Peter, you know that not everybody, even in Silicon Valley, where there's a pretty deep well of optimism on a lot of these fronts, not everyone's so confident. You know, we've talked with a lot of the kind of people that you cite in your book, and many of them have great big ideas. I mean, Elon Musk and Bill Joy and Stuart Brand, Ray Kurzweil, your buddy Eric Schmidt. We've talked with all of them. But you've also got, look at Peter Thiel, one of the PayPal founders, and he's got this article that turned a lot of heads not long ago, The End of the Future. And he says, you know, we're just not up to it. The kind of ambitions we had in the 1950s, 1960s, the track we were on, where we thought we were going, it hasn't happened. We're, you know, speed, our simple speed at which we travel hasn't increased like we thought it would. In the past decade, he says, unresolved energy challenges. Agriculture, tech famine may lead to old-fashioned famine. Blockbuster drugs in the pipeline, not enough. He goes right on down the list. Why do you think somebody like Peter Thiel, who's no fool about this stuff, is pessimistic where you're optimistic?
Well, you know, and I know Peter, and I know all these fellows, and everybody's got a different point of view. Let me give a few more examples here. You know, today, mobile telephony is spreading like wildfire. We have cell phone penetration has gone from 28% in Africa in 2009, expected to hit over 70% in 2013.
How does that feed the people? How does it?
Well, I'll give you the answer. Give me a shot here. We've got a Maasai war in the middle of Kenya, and I speak about this in the book. Today, on a mobile comm, has better mobile telephony than President Reagan did 25 years ago. And if they're on on a smartphone, they've got access to more knowledge and information than President Clinton did 15 years ago. They're living in a state of information communication abundance.
I get that.
These
it's cool, but how does it bring us the water, the food, the energy? Make the linkage.
Give me a shot.
Mm-hmm.
So the tools that these people now are able to have literally for free on their phones is allowing them to earn a living. It's allowing them to be able to have it literally is a – there's a price multiplier, a ability to increase their standards of living 30-fold when they have these. Think about the fact that on a cell phone today, They have access to GPS, video teleconferencing, medical diagnostics, books, you know, music, whatever the things that we used to have to spend thousands or not tens of thousands of dollars for are now available for free
so
on anyone around the world.
So your thesis is it's not just a gizmo. Give human beings access to information and the problems will be solved? Is that an equation you can stand by?
These are the tools that they can use to educate themselves. These are the tools that they can use to help uplift themselves from poverty. We are going from – in 2010, we had 2 billion people connected on the internet. By 2020, that's going to jump up to 5 billion people, 3 billion people who have never been heard from before, who have never plugged into the global conversation are now entering the global economic world. I mean, literally, they're going to become – they're bringing in tens of trillions of dollars of purchasing power. And people say, you know, these people are only making $2 to $10 a day. But do the math. You know, that number times 365 days a year times 3 billion people are tens of trillions of dollars.
It's a business opportunity. But let me just go to this because our time is not infinite. And this is really important. Not everybody in the world has the same confidence that Silicon Valley guy like you may have, that giving in a lot of information to 3 billion more people is going to solve the problems we're looking at. If the – I don't know. How many billion have it already, the access to that information? A lot. If a billion people can't think of solutions, well, 4 billion?
Yes, absolutely, because the rate of innovation is directly proportional to the population and to the amount of information that's exchanged. The fact of the matter is these individuals around the planet are innovating with zero cost. They're innovating in ways that, you know, a breakthrough idea traditionally does not come out of the establishment.
Really?
In fact,
an awful lot has. Look at Bell Labs. You've all been reading about that recently. Look at big government programs that actually, NASA, you name it, brought us a lot of technologies.
Oh, no. Are you kidding me?
You know, no,
NASA is the last person to innovate in this regard. Breakthroughs come. People who are experts are typically prepared to defend their territory. And a real breakthrough comes from someone that is out of the field who comes forward and says, what about doing it this way? Traditionally, you know, most new jobs in America come out of startup companies. They don't come out of the large corporations. Kauffman Foundation proved that in a study last year. I mean, real innovation takes tremendous risk. It literally – the day before something is truly a breakthrough,
yep,
it's a crazy idea. And we don't take crazy ideas in this country anymore. Large corporations are worried about their stock price plummeting. Governments are worried about congressional investigations. Real breakthroughs require taking tremendous risk to life, limb, and all of these things.
You don't buy the Bell Lab argument that is being made now in this new book that says, look, Bell Labs, yeah, could it be, you could see it as stodgy, but they laid down a lot of fundamental science that we're still living off of today.
Yeah, and we're living off of the Apollo legacy from 50 years ago. But for God's sakes, we don't even have an operating system in the United States. I mean, give me a break. It's, you know, innovation really requires the entrepreneur who's going to risk everything. And the more entrepreneurs out there are plugged in, I mean, someone literally in the developing world now has access to Amazon's cloud computing, 3D manufacturing. These are where real innovation is going to take place.
And you're saying that the scarcities that people are worried about are only scarcities until a new innovation comes along, a big innovation that takes what's there and produces a lot
makes
more of
it.
Lets us extract a
makes
lot more.
Makes it accessible.
Makes it accessible.
I mean, we talk about, you know, are we using up all the energy in this planet? No. We have 5,000 times more energy hitting us on the sun. We live on a water planet. 70% covered by water. The problem is 97.5% is salt water, 2% is ice, and we fight over half of the percent of the water. But there are technologies in nanomaterials or whether it's Dean Kamen's slingshot that's coming down the pike that can transform that water to drinkable water. And the number one way to reduce the human population, number one way, educate them and make them healthier.
That is
proven.
Yep. You were out just yesterday talking or debating kind of at arm's length Paul Gilding. You were both giving TED talks yesterday. Of course, we've talked with Paul. He's very gloomy about the future, the great disruption coming and humans destroying the natural resources of the planet. You obviously much more optimistic than that, talking about abundance coming and saying scarcity is contextual and technology is a liberating force. And I'm looking here at Chris Anderson, the TED curator, asked for a show of hands, you know, about whether people there – this was in Long Beach, California, optimism territory. You got 55% of the vote who went with you saying, you know, Peter Diamandis has got it right. It's going to be good. But 45, even in that turf, we're still pretty worried. What do you think of that ratio among the techno the techno elite there?
Well, I want to begin by saying I you know, I agree that we do have problems on this planet. Climate crisis is an issue. Species extinction issue. These things are real. But we also have the ability to drive real breakthroughs. And, you know, you have two choices in life. You can either say, listen, the world's going to, you know, to pot and too bad, woe is me. Or you can say, I'm going to do something about it. And the whole book, the whole thesis of abundance is that we are now empowered as individuals and small teams more than any time in history to attack these problems and focus on them. And I'm not going to sit back and wait for the government or some large corporation to do it. The whole empowerment of individuals to go and solve these problems is a great force for the future.
Hats off. Let's do it. Let's go to our listeners. In a moment, Robert Atkinson joins us from the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. But first, in East Lansing, Michigan, Ben's calling. Ben, you're on the air with XPRIZE CEO Peter Diamandis. What do you think, Ben?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think that we're being a little bit too optimistic here, and it actually concerns me a little bit to hear announced that the future is better than we think, because it really reduces our accountability and our sense of responsibility. There are certainly more issues than energy alone here that we have to worry about. We need diversity, natural diversity, and what about pollution and waste and byproducts?
You're afraid it'll just make us profligate if we think we can innovate our way out of it. But what about our sense of opportunity, our sense of possibility? Do we need to keep that warmed up too, Ben?
Yeah, I guess we do need to keep people thinking in the right direction, but we also need to be concerned and not just not just say, okay, they've got things under control, we don't need to worry. We definitely need to keep that concern up.
Yeah, I don't think Peter will say don't worry, but I take your point. Let me get one more here, and I'll bring it to Peter. Sandy in Chesapeake, Virginia. Thanks, Ben. Sandy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I appreciate the opportunity to ask a question.
Mm-hmm.
I've been around a long time. I'm 68, and I have heard since the 50s when I was growing up all this wonderful new energy that we were going to find, and it seems to me we're still using the same energy. And what I wonder is, do our large energy companies, I've heard people say that we could have 25 cent a gallon gasoline if we could just find a way to turn water into gasoline. But if we did, the gasoline companies would put the quietus on it. So how do we develop new energy sources with this abundance, this solar abundance? Solyndra just went bankrupt.
Hey, Sandy, you don't buy Peter.
Going to develop
it? Peter says, look, we're already doing it. Solar's coming on like gangbusters. You're not seeing that?
I'm not.
Fossil fuel is still the main way. Sandy, I appreciate your call. Peter, let me take those two to you. First, Ben in Michigan saying, don't forget about caution and skepticism. They're important, too, so that we're not just profligate. And Sandy saying, yeah, great, but we're still waiting and an awful lot of fossil fuel is still being burned.
So let's take those one at a time. The first is, to Ben's point, what's incredible is that the alignment of the world's biggest problems are also the world's biggest market opportunities. The companies and technologies that take on and solve energy, water, healthcare, education, food are trillion-dollar opportunities, especially as larger populations of people who need this kind of capability come online and can actually purchase it. So what I'm seeing at least is extraordinary companies popping up in all of these areas. And it's not just a government that's going to try and by edict say, okay, we're gonna do something. You really need a new way to do it.
But it's not just about market opportunity. I mean, the fossil fuel companies also have, their power, their leverage. They've worked against a lot of the development of new energy. There's countervailing forces here.
Yeah. So let's take that on. What's going on now more than ever is the empowerment of the individual. And if the individual has access to different forms of energy so that I can install solar, for example, and get it cheaper than buying it off the grid, that's something, a choice I can do. And that's really where the difference happens. It used to be that the decision as to who provided energy was a governmental decision. And now as we start to empower the individuals to choose, they can choose that which is cheaper or that which is better for the environment. And that's very different than it was, decades ago.
Awful hard to make that choice in a lot of venues right now. You know, the choice is kind of what comes from the power company. Pat in Waynesboro, Pennsylvania. Pat, you're on the air. Hi.
Thank you. I almost ran off the road as I got in the car about 10 minutes ago and started listening to your program. I'm a regular listener. Do you know what the people that we provide self-coverage for in Africa or someplace, how can somebody with $10 a day access Amazon to buy anything or read books or do, you know what they'll do? They will play Angry Birds. They will access inane things, pornography, whatever, but just like we do in the Western Hemisphere, right?
So you don't believe that putting information in the hands of a billion more people is going to bring us the innovation we need to take on our challenges?
No. In fact, if you've read the book, We Meant Well, about what we went in and accessed, gave the people in Iraq, the NGOs that give them chickens, to give them cows.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We don't understand what they need. They need clean water. They need access to sanitary conditions.
Maybe that's just too pessimistic, Pat. Maybe if you get information to people, a lot of people will play Donkey Kong, but somebody out there is going to do something more valuable than that, won't they?
Somebody will, but it only might be a few out of those billions. This is a marketing tool. This is a moneymaker for somebody who's doing this. That's what this is. It's not because of making a better life for somebody else.
Pat, we got it. Peter Diamandis, what do you say?
Well, go check out an organization called the Khan Academy, K-H-A-N. That's online right now. That's a free online educational capability that's being translated into dozens of languages around the world.
Yeah, we know it well. We've talked to Sal Khan right here on this show.
Fantastic. And the ability for someone anywhere on the planet to be able to learn about something they desire, this is not about marketing things they don't need. This is about giving people a life of possibility, not a life of luxury, where the basic needs that we enjoy, that we take for granted, are available to help people uplift themselves from poverty. I mean, when you're spending all of your days searching for water or trying to just, you know, heat yourself, I mean, you can't do anything else. And really, it's about the whole book. And in fact, I've made chapter one available for free to everybody online on abundancethebook.com. Read it. It gives the basic thesis of it. The goal is to create a world where people can start solving problems instead of complaining about them. Isn't that what we really want? Empowered people solving the problems out there?
I think the idea of empowerment is one that everybody will respond to. I think that people also, well, you've heard it already, they're cautious of something that may leave us just profligate. They're skeptical about whether that power will really be passed around. They wonder if our systems are set up correctly to unleash the kind of human capacity that it's really heartwarming to hear you talk about, Peter, and we're glad for it. The new book is Abundance. The Future is Better Than You Think. When we come back, Robert Atkinson joins us, and listeners, you can join us as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about the quality of our future on this planet, maybe beyond it, and the power of innovation to save our bacon. With us right now from Washington, D.C. is Robert Atkinson. He's founder and president of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, author of The Past and Future of America's Economy, and the forthcoming Innovation Economics, The Race for Global Advantage. Robert Atkinson, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Now, we know that you've been actually warning about the pace and quality of American innovation. Now, for several years now, your outfit's been saying that there's a troubling trend here. Peter Diamandis looks and says, hey, we've got abundance coming. We're lined up to do great. We're just civilians here. Help us think this through. What do you see, Robert?
Well, you know, a couple of months ago, I debated Tyler Cowen, who had a sort of antithesis book called The Great Stagnation, and Tyler's the opposite of Peter.
Pessimistic, because we don't have the stuff coming. We don't have it on the way.
Exactly. And I took the other side. I said, no, it's not stagnation. We're making progress. I actually take the exact opposite side with Peter. We're not in a period of abundance. If I write a book, I call it, yeah, we're doing okay. We'll continue to do okay.
He's looking forward. Are we at least lined up with an innovation opportunities in the pipeline or coming or made possible by new technology that will bring us abundance?
No, absolutely not. Just think about the fact that the median world income is $850 a year. And every year, what global productivity growth is 3.5%. In other words, every year we get 3.5% richer. So let's just say, for example, for some strange reason, which there's no evidence to show that this will happen, but for some strange reason, we double that for the next 25 years.
Okay.
We get to $4,000 median world income. So we're not talking about abundance. We're talking about something that has never, ever happened in world history to get to the abundance vision that Peter is talking about.
4,000 is a lot better than 850. That would be some happy campers.
But what point Peter makes in his book, which is he's talking about the kinds of standards of living for everybody on the globe that high-income people in America make. That just simply cannot happen in the next even 200 years.
And what about
the
health?
So we're just not going to get that kind of growth.
We'll look at that with Peter. What about the health of our innovation culture in this country or globally? Look at R&D around the world. Are we doing the big stuff that we have done out of the 20th century? Are we lined up to sort of do it all again or do it better?
No. In fact, that's the troubling part, which Peter has not talked about. To me, you really look at where a lot of core innovation comes from, and it really does come from the government. You look at almost every single information technology, and it traces its roots back to government support for research. If the federal government had continued to invest in R&D, in science, at the pace they did in the 1950s, 60s, and early 70s, we would be investing as a country $130 billion more than we do. And unfortunately, we're not, because we have this anti-government view. And that's, to me, the most troubling part of what Peter's book is about. It's very much a libertarian vision. It's individuals are going to do this. We don't need society. We don't need collective action. We don't need government to be funding science at our universities and supporting innovation that way. This is all going to be built. We'll all rely on Bill Gates and on somebody with a little nanomachine. And that's just simply not going to happen. Now, again, to be fair.
Why not? We are more empowered than we used to be. We do have access to a lot more information power anyway.
Yeah, but you know, Peter says 3 billion people are going to come online. 2.99 billion of them are going to have less than an eighth grade education. And you cannot invent the next cancer drug when you have an eighth grade education. I'm sorry. You have to actually have an advanced degree in bioscience or molecular science. So in other words, all of these innovations really, they come from people who have deep technical knowledge and not from just somebody scanning the internet and coming up with some idea. That's where innovation comes from. It comes from scientists and engineers who really dig into that. The fact that 3 billion people are going to come online, or the fact that you can store your data on Amazon Cloud Server, again, it doesn't really make any difference.
Peter Diamandis, let me bring these to you. Let's start with abundance itself. You hear Robert saying, well, that's not coming. How do you define abundance, Peter? What are you saying is coming within a generation? Peter Diamandis, are you there? We lost Peter. We'll try and get him back. Let me ask you, you say that U.S. investment, government investment in innovation has fallen off. What about others around the world? Are there others who will pick up the slack and bring on the innovation even if the U.S. doesn't do it?
That's true. Now, if you're talking about being a citizen of the world, things aren't as bad because you get other countries like Israel, China, even places like Sweden and Canada who are increasing their support for research and development. We're one of the few countries in the world who is not. We're actually going down as a share of our gross domestic product from the government side and stagnant from the business side. So the real problem is if you're looking at it from I'm an American, that's much more troubling, because for us to thrive as a country and for us to have better standards of living, we've got to win the innovation race. And that's the real worry I have, is other countries are getting a lot farther ahead of us and making the kinds of investments that they need to do to get ahead.
We're trying to get Peter Diamandis back here. Let's bring in our listeners again. Alan in Edgefield, South Carolina. Alan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. Really enjoy the show. I'm very encouraged by Peter's perspective. I do support it, and I'm sorry I didn't get the other guest's name.
But Robert Atkinson, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that as well. I believe there is a role for government to play. But I look at it as if you give people the tools to innovate, to participate unless you don't have a desire to continue to exist, they will push those boundaries in every way they can to their benefit and to the benefit of all. And you have no idea how that will evolve. You know, and the example is the, you know, sensitive dependence on initial conditions, the butterfly effect. And I think if you give people those tools to innovate, they will, and it's the natural way.
So on balance, you're optimistic there, Alan. Sounds to me anyway. Duncan in Lexington, Massachusetts. Alan, thank you. Duncan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. Yes, I'm also one of the optimistic camp.
Great.
I think that there are a lot of opportunities out there, particularly in terms of funding, the way microfinance has been kind of slowly building, and how Kickstarter projects, which are, you know, kind of small scale at the moment, but their funding has surpassed the National Endowment for the Arts.
But isn't microfinance, isn't that mainly about, I mean, most famously about, I don't know, helping young mothers in Bangladesh set up some kind of small business?
Exactly. You know, if someone has an idea, you know,
But does that produce the science for us?
Somewhere can make big differences.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, the global information can help that happen. And, you know, the people who are playing Angry Birds, you know, just won't be participating.
But still, again, there you've got optimism about kickstarting from the ground level up. Peter DeMendes, I hope you're back with us now. Here, I'm sorry we lost you.
I'm back, and I'd love to respond to some of Robert's points.
Yes, please. And if you could start with your definition of abundance, he's saying it's not going to be abundant. What, but how do you define it? With intergeneration, what?
And that's thank you for that, because it's not about giving everybody in the world a life of luxury. And it doesn't matter that they're not earning thousands of dollars if all of a sudden your basic needs of electricity and water and food and shelter and health and education can be purchased for within your income. That's what I'm speaking about. In other words, the cost of providing these basics for life is plummeting. So that, again, someone who literally is on a cell phone, that was something only the most wealthiest on the planet could have. But now if it's $80 for an Android phone, you can microfinance it. Then you have that access. You have abundant information communication.
But you're not saying they're going to be driving an Escalade and living in a McMansion.
No. The whole book is about how do we provide people the basics for life that frees up their time so they can self-educate, that they can start becoming productive. These are, you know, if water becomes available through Dean Kamen's Slingshot for less than 2 cents a liter, and in the developing world they're spending 30 cents a day, you know, a third of their income on $2 a day for water, that frees up money for them to do other things. These are the forces in play.
And what about Robert Atkinson says, look, you've got to have some big government investment in here. It has worked in the past, and we're going to need it now,
and
you can't just farm it all out.
And nowhere do I say that government funding is not valuable.
But we've heard you diss government loud and clear in the course of this hour multiple times.
But I'm not dependent on the government. So, for example, we talk about NASA being an example. I mean, the fact is the great hope for the American space program is SpaceX, an individual Elon Musk who started PayPal, has invested hundreds of millions of dollars to get his technology going, and now NASA becomes a customer for that. It didn't originate out of NASA labs. I mean, it's about the American industrial entrepreneurship base. That's what's been driving our economy for the last 20 years and will continue to going forward.
But Robert Atkinson says, look, the fact is we're not on an innovation tear. We're in an innovation lull, and it's partly because we're not making the right investments to raise the arc. What do you say, Peter?
Well, I see it very different. I see we have tremendous breakthroughs coming on in synthetic biology, in cloud computing, in AI, in robotics. I mean, a lot of the most interesting robotics work, for example, is coming out of a company called Willow Garage, which is one of the early Googlers who's invested his hundreds of millions of dollars to create a new generation. I mean, I'm not seeing it out of the government labs, because the risks required to drive these breakthroughs are of, you know, take or fail, and we don't allow for failure in our current system.
Let's go to Alton in Brookline, Massachusetts. Alton, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think that DeMendes is about half right, because I don't know if you're familiar with archaeofuturism, it sort of looks to the future and says we're going to see these things, and there's a French guy, Guillaume Fay, who basically has sort of a bifurcated view of the future. It's kind of taken Charles Murray's work that you just had on the show last week or so,
yeah,
and this together and saying there's going to be this super elite that have all the things that Mr. Diamandis is talking about, and there's going to be the non-elite, which doesn't. What? And I think he's making a mistake in assuming people in the third world or wherever, just not his culture, think like he does.
Well, I mean, Charles Murray says it's going to be that way right here in the United States. We're going to have a sort of Latin America old-style economy where super elite and everybody else in trouble and kind of at each other's throats and not well-educated and all the rest. But why shouldn't these technologies spread the opportunity around, Alton?
Well, I mean, if you look right now, the Peace Corps has been in Ghana for 50 years and they're still digging wells. The people don't seem to have the same impetus to improve their life that folks here do. They don't see things the same way. I mean, for better or for worse, it's just everyone doesn't share your worldview or what you want to do. And you can try and make them, and maybe they will when it's convenient for them, but to sit there and assume that everyone is going to want the better way of life as you see it, I just don't see that happening.
Peter Diamandis, let us pick that up if we may. Charles Murray was with us a week or so ago. We had strong pushback to him as well, but the case he makes is that we're on a bad path here. We've got a lot of people who aren't picking up the sort of education needed to do this kind of innovation, and that we're headed toward a kind of Latin American economy, even right here in the United States. Alton says it's a problem globally.
Well, you know, there's a new book out by Charles Kenny that shows that global literacy rates have gone from 25% to 80% over the last 130 years. You know, from my standpoint, it's really – listen, I'm not going to say that everybody on the planet is going to want this, but people are going to want basic health care. They're going to want the ability to educate their kids. And education and health care is one of the most important things that we can provide out there. It drops global population rates. Morocco, for example, went from 7.8 children per family to 2.8 when the new government systems came in and provided better health and education. And that's, I think, one of the biggest potentials we have for – I mean, if you look at the work that Nicholas Negroponte has done on one laptop per child, he has some brand new tablets coming out that allow literally for pennies per day for a kid to have access to all the educational and reading material that they could possibly want. I mean, listen – all we can do is provide these basic needs and allow people to help pull themselves up.
Robert Atkinson, you're skeptical on a number of fronts. We've heard it already. Is there something, though, in this – what I hear is a kind of Silicon Valley mindset, though it's not only Silicon Valley, but, you know, that is attuned to these challenges and will approach them in a way that you're just not seeing? Or is there something in this mindset that's missing something about the scale and range of our challenges and what it's going to take to go after them, Robert?
Yeah, no, it's very much, Tom, a Silicon Valley mindset, at least a portion of Silicon Valley, which historically is sort of ahistorical. They think that Silicon Valley emerged just from a few brilliant entrepreneurs and forget that in 1992, Santa Clara County, the sort of heart of Silicon Valley, was the most defense-dependent county in the country, and that most of the big innovations that came out of the valley can trace their way back to federal support of some kind. So it's not as if I disagree with Peter in saying that there won't be really, really great technologies. And I, you know, I applaud Peter for pointing out that there's a new technology system that's emerging. It's more what people call open innovation. That's all true. Yeah, but what bothers me about Peter's vision is that it's this either or. There's nothing in the book really about that I was aware of that talking about that you need both of these things, that you do need the big innovation systems. You do need big corporations. You do need government to play a much bigger role than they're playing. These aren't either or kinds of debates. And yet Peter's vision and kind of the Silicon Valley libertarian TED vision is it's all about these brilliant individuals and a few people are given some money.
Are we halfway toward addressing the challenges in front of us in this century, Robert? Are we a quarter? Are we 90%? I mean, do we have innovation coming that's going to save our bacon or not?
Yeah, we do. I mean, I'm a fundamental techno-optimist. We will get cheap, clean energy at some point. But, you know, I'll tell you, one of the ways we're going to get it is, for example, is funding what's called ARPA-E, which is having its big annual conference here this week in Washington. It's the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy. It's part of the Department of Energy. It just announced through its funding, not some entrepreneurs' funding, its funding, battery technology, new lithium battery technology that's four times better than what's in the Volt today or the Tesla.
There's hope right there.
Got to have government to help.
Well, maybe takes all of the above. Maybe Robert Atkinson with the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation in Washington. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Peter Diamandis, we are glad that you're out there raising that sunny flag for the future, and we wish that scenario well. Keep telling us, and thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Peter Diamandis, co-author of Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think. Let's take it all. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.